When we think about inclusion, what does that really mean? The same is true when we think about community. Who all are included or potentially excluded? How might we take meaningful action to truly embrace inclusion and community? And are we willing to acknowledge our own internalized racist ideas? Listen to my thought-provoking conversation with Dr. Abdulrahman as he discusses his personal and professional journey in leading and building inclusion as part of his work. Welcome to People of Color in Psychology, the show that explores mental health topics specific to culture, diversity, and communities of color. I am your host, Jack Sen. We have Dr. Abdulrahman as our guest today. He is a clinical and consulting psychologist. Dr. Abdulrahman applies his skills of creating sustainable change to leadership in diversity, equity, and inclusion. He has a broad and international portfolio of clients, including Google, YouTube, MasterCard Foundation, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and is a member of the Conference Board of Canada. He hosts a podcast on the different conversations of racism called Different People. Dr. Abdulrahman's work has been recognized by the Society of Consulting Psychology for Excellence in Diversity and Inclusion Consulting. As a TEDx speaker on resolving unconscious bias and the founder of testbias.com and livingwithracism.com, he believes insight of our biases can be the beginning of a resolution to systemic racism. He is an assistant professor with the Department of Clinical Health Psychology at the University of Manitoba and has held 3 visiting professor positions at Zanzibar University, the State University of Zanzibar, and the Muhimbili University of Health and Allied Sciences due to development work in Tanzania. He is also the author of a new book in press titled Developing Anti-Racist Cultural Competence, due out in early 2024. As a Muslim Zanzibari psychologist, Dr. Abdulrahman will be discussing how changing our sense of community can improve inclusion. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Jack.
Yeah, first of all, thank you so much for being a part of this conversation. I've had, you know, the opportunity to listen to your podcast and really some insightful things that you shared. One thing that I ask a lot of the guest speakers is, tell me more about yourself, your origin story, and how did you get into this work?
Yeah, my origin story is very interesting. It feels in many ways I've come full circle. My family moved to Canada when I was about 7 years old. Our family faced a fair deal of discrimination growing up. And as a result, although I didn't realize it as a child, my father, and as most immigrant parents, you know, they give their children 3 options, a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer. And my father said, you're going to be a physician. That was it. And like a very specific kind of doctor, physician. And it didn't make sense to me growing up, but given that he faced so much discrimination in the work world, as a leader himself in the work world and business, he felt he didn't want his children to go through the same thing, having to struggle with employment. He didn't want them to face racism. And I remember him having challenges, him coming home, you know, leading the management as a leader in many organizations, retail businesses. And he would hire a lot of immigrants and people of color, and him being told in the 80s, 90s, you know, that don't hire more people of color, like you should be hiring more white people. And he would say, well, you know, I'm going to hire the right people for the job. And then they'd fire him. And then he'd get to a different organization, be high up in leadership, hire more people of color, and they get fired for doing so. So, you know, he, having had that, he's like, I don't want you losing a job. I want you to, we didn't grow up very well off. We struggled growing up. I remember when we first moved to Canada, like a lot of, like the only meat our family could afford were like organ meat. And I remember, you know, growing up being disgusted by kidneys and having to eat those and not even having the money to buy toys. So like the experience of being an immigrant is one thing, but the challenges that we faced with racism created another layer of trauma, I think, for family, particularly for my parents. My father never wanted me to go through that. And so for him, having his children going into being a physician or in health particularly, was critically important because it meant, he said, people always need a doctor. They always, in his mind, doctor meant physician. You know, people always need a doctor, and then you'll never lose a job. Thinking that even in higher education and in health, there wouldn't be that level of discrimination. And so when I went into psychology, so I, you know, I was in high school at the time, and there's not very many psychologists of my background, but there was one. He was a Muslim psychologist. He was Egyptian. And I remember we were at a wedding, and I was just in the tail end of high school. And for me, I wanted to go into a field that told me why people did things. And so initially I thought that medicine would really provide that answer of why. And what I realized over time that it wasn't why, it was how people did things. And that psychology was really providing the answers of why people did certain things. So anyhow, the psychologist said, you should go into psychology, he said. And he goes, we have a job waiting for you in the department. And now I took that quite literally, thinking, you know, with that pressure of needing a job and wanting to survive, having gone through, I was like, okay. And I love psychology, so I went into it. Sure enough, I ended up working in the department. I was given a job in the department, which is a rare position.
And this is the department in Canada or Egypt?
Yeah,
or?
The Department of Clinical Health Psychology.
Oh.
Actually, where I'm still an assistant professor, and I still teach. So I went through that, but I didn't tell my father right away. You know, because it would have bothered him. And I remember it was third year university. I was still living with my parents. And I got very proudly a Department of Psychology mug and putting it at the very back end of the shelf so that when my father woke up for morning breakfast, he wouldn't open the cabinet and see that psychology mug. Because he was not happy about it initially. And I know I've worked with a lot of young people of color and people come from immigrant families, and that's a common worry, right? When you go through the challenges that you do, you don't want your children to go through that. It took my father a while for him to articulate that. He goes, I just don't want you to go through what I went through, which is why I wanted you to go into medicine. And it took me a long time, and I was persistent and stubborn, and I stayed in the field that I wanted to stay in. He's very proud, obviously. Like, there was no judgment about the profession. He was just worried about the future. Now, I went into clinical psych, interestingly enough, wanting to help people, wanted to work with kids. And I have a lot of experience with childhood trauma. But I ended up with anxiety disorders and trauma and a lot of cross-cultural work. But as time went on, I began to get frustrated that it was like, why am I why is it always falling on me as a person of color to do this work? Like, why shouldn't this be like other people's work too? I have since grown from that, and I believe that there's something to be said for lived experience, but it bothered me that it just fell on my shoulders. So I used to push away that work, even though it was work that I was qualified to do, it was bothering me. But when my son was not even 3 years old, I remember him buckling into his car seat, and he said to me, Papa, I don't want to be Muslim anymore. And it really struck me because at that age, I don't think he even knows what that means. And when I asked him why he didn't want to be a Muslim, he said it's because Paw Patrol, which is a cartoon he watches, doesn't celebrate Christmas anymore. So it was really striking to me that it wasn't even just about, you know, I started this thing about wanting to figure out why people did things, and it really struck me that it wasn't just overt racism, you know, that caused him to have that internalized racism or Islamophobia, but it was the absence of inclusion, right? Like, I mean, it was the indirect racism of a lack of inclusion. And it really struck me. And then it was like, okay, I really felt like I needed to do something about this. Like, I was trained and I work with cross-cultural psychology. I'm a clinician. I provide this very practical means of creating change. I was like, no, I need to really take my work in this direction. So I am a clinician. I run a clinic. But I was like, I really need to do that. So now I'm back in this line of work, ironically, helping businesses not do to their employees what was happening to my father. So whereas my father didn't want me to go into a profession where he didn't want me to go into psychology. And now I'm back in a profession because he didn't want me to face what he went through. And now I'm helping businesses prevent that happening to their employees. So in some ways, it feels very odd. It wasn't planned, but I've weirdly, perhaps poetically, come back.
Yeah.
Position that would have prevented my father from going
from going through that. Yeah. Yeah. In many ways, it is that experience of coming full circle and the experiences, the lack of economic opportunities. And for your father to have gone through that, and I think he's a leader in many ways by promoting and advocating for people of color, hiring them on board.
Yes.
And then to get fired by that is very, very disheartening. Yeah. And to be told explicitly, you need to hire more white folks, as opposed to you just need to hire more people who are qualified.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember first time hearing you talk about the situation with your son through your podcast, and I didn't realize that he was only 3 years old when that happened.
Yeah,
such a young age.
He wasn't even three. And I talk about it in the TED Talk as well, too, because it was such a critical moment for me. And it's funny, after I gave that TED Talk, how many people of color came up to me and said, I felt that way. Like, I wanted to be white. Mm-hmm. There were times in life that I wanted to be white. There are times I still want to be white. You know, and sometimes, for many reasons, for the ease of things, for acceptability, you know, for culture, for beauty, or perceived beauty, so to speak, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was striking to me how many people had that thought and how many of us are walking around with this internalized racism. And to me, racism is very much, and I mentioned this in the book, racism is no longer the burning cross on our lawns. It's the burning cross in our minds. You know, we've taken to policing ourselves. You know, any successful brainwashing strategy gets people to believe something that you want. And then you don't have to police them as vigorously as you would have, you know, as violently, because they're policing themselves, you know. And so when we think about racism, we have to think about it in a modern day perspective as a psychological concept that changes the way people think and feel about not only people who are different from themselves, but also about themselves.
And I've had that thought growing up.
Yeah.
Right. Because like the perceived beauty, the ease, these folks have access to things. I think it also speaks to the in-group, out-group experience.
Absolutely.
Be accepted.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Which dovetails into one of your primary message here is how changing our sense of community can improve inclusion. Can you share with me your perspective on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, what's interesting is that a lot of people of color generally see themselves as a part of a larger, broader community in North America or in most Western worlds. We understand the nuances of the culture. We adopt a lot of the holidays. We engage and participate with many of our white colleagues and friends as if they belong to our community. We have an intersecting sense of identity. You know, we may have our own personal cultural or religious community, but we also see many people who are not from that community as a part of our community. We make efforts to learn about and understand those different viewpoints, and we respect and we value them so much so that we integrate them into our own calendars and our viewpoints. The same can't be said for many white folks, sadly. We take, for example, the idea of holidays. We all know what Christmas is. We get what that is. We know what Easter is. We know what Halloween is. And many of us will adopt a lot of those holidays, even if they aren't from our own culture. But that can't be said the other way around. And so many white folks, I would argue, you know, just by logic sense, don't really, they might say verbally that they would see us as a part of their community, but there's no action-based event that would demonstrate that they've really included us and our worldview as a part of their community worldview as well, too. And so it's difficult to work on racism when we're perpetually seen as outsiders. Now, I developed this bias outside the box tool. And interestingly enough, what shows up in there is that people tend to persistently see people of color as foreigners. Mm. You know, so what we see is logically happening. We know we can confirm that now with a large body of data, you know, that shows that people of color are persistently seen as foreigners. Now, that also applies to a lot of Indigenous people, where if you speak with Indigenous people, they'll say, you know, even though they are the indigenous people of this land, they are treated like they are foreigners. And that, you know, what is seen as the commonplace Canadian or American way of living is not indigenous, not our first peoples. It is a Eurocentric white culture.
Now, may I ask this, either the data or from your experience, does this apply from a European person, or is it also, for instance, a person of color also assessing another person of color as being outside?
Yeah, and so the data shows actually that bias exists across the board, that it is highly more prevalent in white people. Ironically, we tend to see far more biases in white women than we do in white men. And that might come from, you know, us telling white men for the longest time that they've got to address those issues. So maybe there's some growth there. But we see far more biases in white women than we do in white men in some cases. But people of color hold those biases too, perhaps less so. But we are likely to see other people of color as foreign. And that speaks to that internalized racism, you know? And so when that's the case, what we see as local, what we see as what I refer to in my book as the white standard, is whiteness. And that's white supremacy at its best, that we've all agreed upon without really talking about it, that what we see as normal, what we see as more beautiful, what we see as more productive, what we see as local, and even based on research, what we see as the ideal leader is white. And so we can't really resolve racism, bias, xenophobia, all of those things, if we don't belong in the same community. That belonging of being in the same community has to go both ways. It cannot go one way. It can't be people like you and me, you know, seeing, you know, any relationship has to go two ways. If you're in a relationship with somebody, you can't just say, well, I love you and I'll do all these things to make you feel comfortable and to make you feel like you have a sense of belonging, and the other person doesn't do anything. You know, that's imbalanced, and I would say in some cases an abusive relationship, where one person in that relationship is taking advantage of the other person, always seeing themselves as more important, prioritizing their own needs as more important, and assuming that that's what the other person thinks too. Well, these relationships go beyond just couples and families and friends. They apply societally as well too. And it is a one-way relationship. So in order for us to be able to work to resolve racism, we do need to shift what it means to be in a same community. Like, it can't be lip service. It has to be based on some action. And so one of the things that I've been really pushing for is this concept. Like, our team several years ago developed a civic pride campaign based on positive psychology. So tips that people can engage in to build greater civic pride. One of those tips was celebrate everything, and that we need to move, including shifting our cultural and holiday calendar, to make sure that we're including holidays that include the holidays of all Canadians, of all Americans, you know, into our holiday. That, you know, and people are like, well, you can take the day off. No. That's not equity. I'm not looking for a handout. And it's not about me just having the day off. It's about everybody else knowing that this is also a Canadian or American holiday.
Yeah, that this holiday is available for everyone.
Yes.
It's not, yeah, yeah.
Because it is American or Canadian holiday. Mm-hmm. Because those people are Canadian and American, right? Those people are North American, they belong here. So in the same way that Christmas is not just a European holiday, or Easter is not just a European holiday, it is, you know, it is a Canadian one. So we can't just go by the prevailing one group of people and their culture and their worldview over others. And the moment we do that, I think we engage in very active but quiet racism.
Yeah. So I think one concrete example that I like what you're alluding to here is thinking about just even the way we celebrate holidays. Because when we think about celebration, there's an appreciation. It goes beyond just giving you a day off. There's actual involvement, investment in the day, and learning more about the day. And really making it our own. So whether you're white, black, brown, you know, you see it as, oh, this is all part of the holiday that we have.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. And then we can choose to incorporate elements of those holidays or just simply be respectful and understand and help other people who do celebrate those holidays celebrate citywide, organization-wide. When people who don't belong to those communities or those sub-communities get those days off, think about the value and the appreciation they would have for those people to have that day off.
Yeah.
I appreciate having a day off on Christmas. I don't celebrate Christmas, but gosh darn it, I appreciate the day off.
Yes.
And thank you for Christmas because, you know, we all get to shut down for a while. I like that. I take advantage of the sales. Thank goodness for that.
Yes, I take advantage of that. I think it goes to say that you create a holiday, though, for people to celebrate. Now, I think more practically speaking from a clinical perspective, so people who are, you know, psychologists, mental health professionals who are working with clients and want to instill and embrace this idea of basically creating a sense of community to actually improve inclusion. Because I think the piece that you are adding is the community piece, like bringing people on board and making them feel more as a community. If I were working individually with a client, how might I carry on these ideas or principles that you have?
Well, I think when we're in a community, we decenter one person, right? And right now we've centered whiteness. And there's an unspoken kind of truth that we believe that everything needs to be white-centered. How we engage with people, our understanding of time, our understanding of what we expect, even social development, you know, where people live, you know, what we expect in terms of relationship roles and how engaged people are with their family of origin. There, everything is based, even psychologically speaking, right? I mean, the term enmeshed is used often to describe many families of color, assuming that that's an unhealthy thing because it's based on a white standard. I think the work needs to be to decenter whiteness. You know, I think that's really the work that needs to happen clinically, both for white practitioners and practitioners of color, because we don't recognize that we have internalized that centering whiteness and that white supremacy in our own minds as well too. So there needs to be that work done for clinicians where they are being thoughtful about what white supremacy means and how much of that they've internalized. And it needs to be as much about the clinician learning as much as it's about the client in this case. I think we do this as educated health professionals. We do this on a regular basis for people we see belonging from the same community. So for example, well, it's easy for white practitioners to stop and slow down and understand women's issues if they're not a woman because they belong to the same community. I'm not saying that we're perfect on addressing women's rights, but I think we've done a little bit better. If we're addressing issues tied to sexuality or people from the queer community, we make an effort. We understand. In fact, I mean, we look everywhere and we're using pronouns, which is good, and we should have been doing that a long time ago. But we haven't moved as fast when it comes to people of color and issues of inclusion. In fact, we're still kind of, you know, really suffering. You know, any person of color will tell you that they keep quiet about the challenges that they face with racism. It is, in fact, the biggest secret in North America, I would say. And I would say, why is that? And I think it's because I don't think we're still included as a part of that community. There still is a centering of the needs of white people. And so when white people belong to marginalized groups, we talk about white women and we talk about women's rights, and we talk about white people in the queer community. You know, the moment that white people are involved in a marginalized community, we move very fast to work, or faster to address issues of equity. We don't seem to do that for people of color. And I think that that's where we have to really review. So we can do that. My point is that we can do that. We stop and we slow down and we understand. And we have a sense of comfort because we have a sense of relatability when we people are like us. I think working with people we perceive to be different from us is challenging. I think the concept of the fear of being called a racist, the fear of coming across as racist, can really hinder people's abilities, their natural abilities to slow down, to be empathic, to be vulnerable and humble, to decenter themselves. And I think that anxiety can sometimes cause people to accidentally put their foot in their mouth. And that ultimately ruins trust.
It is also very unfortunate that when people are thinking about racism, it's like, you know, back in the day, it's overt, you know, as opposed to more the subtle racism or racist ideas and practices that are happening. And rather than seeing it as, we grew up in a very Eurocentric, white dominant society. So therefore, a lot of the ideas that I've internalized and embedded do hold some racist ideas.
Yes.
And there's nothing wrong with acknowledging that fact. I think there's a challenge with people seeing it as that.
Yes.
And they identify it as, oh no, I am racist, as opposed to, and I think this speaks to sort of the perspective. I grew up in a society with these ideas and I've learned these ideas, but it doesn't make me racist. It's these ideas.
Yes. We can engage in racist behavior without intentionally meaning to be racist.
Correct.
You know, that we can engage in behaviors that we've accidentally picked up. And it's really about being mindful about what's happening and learning. I think once you see it, it's really hard to unsee. And we also recognize it's not really as subtle as we think it is. It's just simply internalized. Mm-hmm. You know, we loosen up on the obvious things. You know, we're not drinking from separate water fountains and things like that. But hey, you know, we still do pay more to white people than we do to people of color. When we talk about the gender pay gap, you know, actually the pay gap between white people and people of color is far greater. You know, and that's not subtle. That's pretty damn obvious. Mm-hmm. Even in terms of hiring policies, we know that people of color who anglicize their names are up to 40% more likely to have a job interview. I mean, that's not subtle. You know, these are very profound things. The only thing is that we've simply accepted them as a standard into our culture, assuming that a healthy thing to do is to quote unquote acculturate. And really, that never really happens. All we're doing is code switching at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. You know, we turn on and turn off to make white people comfortable. And I mean, that's a very tiring concept, I think, at some point, you know, is we have to stop performing.
Yeah.
You know, and that doesn't do any benefit to white people either, because there's no opportunity for learning.
Right. Right. And thinking about, you know, this podcast and a message for our listeners, we have a wide range of folks who listen. Mm-hmm. And I think for the therapists who are white and are listening to this, is there a tip that you would offer them?
Yeah. Well, number one, I would say we've got to be comfortable with having these conversations. And many times people are afraid that if they do something that's offensive, that they'll never come back from it. But personally, like if somebody were to take ownership, I feel far more comfortable with them than if they were to be quiet, because then I get the perception that people are digging in their heels and not willing to change. So making an error and admitting to it is actually a far more open act and something that would build trust. You know, it gets people off their high horse. It reduces any power disparity. So I would say that's important, that we need to start to have these conversations and admit errors when they do occur. I also think it's time that we start to pay attention to how common racism is in our society. And that means also learning from our friends. Many times people will say that they want to be anti-racist and work cross-culturally, but in their own personal lives, how many friends of color do they have? And the answer is usually not very many. And so what that suggests is that's performative. So I think, you know, I have a chapter in my book called Outside the Therapy Room. And that's really where a lot of this work needs to begin. Mm. It doesn't begin in the therapy room. It begins outside the therapy room. And we have to do this work to become anti-racist, to educate and inform ourselves outside of that room, so that what we learn shows up in the therapy room.
Yeah, that's such a critical point. Yeah. I'm also glad that you are creating some comfort in the discomfort by saying it's okay to acknowledge a mistake. And actually, a personal experience, I had a colleague who hired a consultant who is Asian. And that colleague saw me and called me by the other Asian person's name.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Right. And then later on, the colleagues apologized profusely and even created some space to process how could I have handled that. And I thought that was such an enriching experience, and I felt closer to my white colleague when they did that.
Yeah.
So I do really want to echo this message for our white colleagues who are listening. It's okay to make mistakes.
It is. And we do that in other areas. Yeah. We accept errors in other areas, but when it comes to this, it's very hard for people to accept the error because the fear of being called racist has very significant consequences. And this is the truth. But one of the recommendations I make to organizations is to come up with a policy statement that allows the ability for people to make mistakes and learn. You know, where we have to have very serious kind of consequences is where people are refusing to make that effort. You know, where they are refusing to admit those issues, because that suggests, you know, rigidity in mindset. And I think ultimately cultural competence is about a fluidity in mindset to be able to see a different perspective. And we know, as you and I know as psychologists, that that is one of the most healthy things that an individual can have is a fluid mindset to be able to take other perspectives.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate a lot of the messages that you are delivering here. And so one thing that I ask a lot of my guest speakers, and you've alluded to some of this, as a person of color, can you share with me one of the challenges that you went through and overcame that you would like to share with us?
One of the hardest things that I've had to face is to recognize the racism in the professional world. Not just, like, I think amongst psychologists, amongst other professionals. It's a very bizarre experience. And I'm not sure that I've overcome this. I think it's a process of ongoing strife for me. That in one part of my life, I work very hard and I'm respected for the work that I'm doing when it comes to anti-racism, unconscious bias, and cultural competence. And then on the other hand, you know, I lose my privilege the moment I step out of that zone. You know, and it's a very conflicted experience where on one hand, people will respect and value the work that you do. And then on the other hand, you're treated like garbage, you know, that you're not believed, that people treat you poorly. And I'd be lying to tell you that I haven't had personal experiences where who I was ethnically, religiously, racially, haven't impacted negative judgments about me. You know, what hurts me the most that impacts my son. It's like living two lives. And that's a very challenging piece, to live your life amidst the hot and the cold. And it creates some pessimism, I mean, sometimes, because it's the same people within organizations that I'm there to educate are the same people who are I'm facing the discrimination with. So it's very, very striking sometimes when you have that double-edged experience. And I'm not sure that I've overcome that. And I speak to it in my book when I talk about a model of ethnic and cultural identity development, that I think that, you know, we talked about people wanting to be white, you know, and that comes with our ethnic identity development, really push ourselves down and work really hard to become who we are and to be accepted for who we are. But then we get, you know, knocked off the pedestal in some way, so to speak, the pedestal of privilege that most people have because they're white. We don't have, you know, once I leave my office, I'm just the average brown guy. I'm just a typical Muslim. And then all of the stereotypes apply. And that is incredibly hurtful and painful. And people will often praise me for, you know, how calmly I can address this professionally. Oh, you do things so calmly. And I'm like, well, you haven't seen me in my personal life. And there are times when you're not having to educate people where, what do you do with that hurt? How do you deal with that? And in those cases, sadly, you know, especially being an, like, being somebody who's Muslim, like the concept of an angry Muslim man applies. And so ironically, the more you advocate for yourself, the more you fit the stereotype. And there's no way out of it. So your options are to fit the stereotype and have and be incredibly discriminated against, or submit to the discrimination. You know, there's no option in between. And it's only when I live my life as this alternate version of myself, you know, doctoral level psychologist who's worked with these big companies, it's only when I put on that, I'm seen with that typecast below on the screen with my name on it, that, oh, we'll pay attention to him. And it really, to me, speaks to the ability to translate that knowledge. And it's why I've done a lot of this work, because to me, this is about knowledge translation. And that's, we're really failing when it comes to that. I think we, as a society, have done so much when it comes to understanding health, well-being, and science, but how do we translate that?
Yeah.
You know, we've translated science really well, so the average person can have access to a phone. Think about the level of technology, but when it comes to health and well-being, have we done that?
Yeah. The implementation piece.
Yeah, is very poor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest challenges that I struggle with. And I'm afraid that I will constantly struggle with that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, first of all, thanks for sharing that struggle, because you are caught in this hard place. You're stuck. You know, if you're in this role doing anti-racist work, doing research, you can breathe. I'm acknowledged. They know my work. But once I move outside of that, I'm going to, I don't know, to Target or something, things change. Right. I'm different. There's people look at me and navigate around my space a little differently, these subtle nuances. I'm different.
But it's also that in very serious cases where we live with other professionals.
It is not
daily lives. It is the things that impact very serious issues in our lives that involve other professionals who carry these biases as well too. That ultimately engage in very racist behavior because they have a very poor understanding of their own biases.
Yeah, and the professionals have more power and influence.
They do, absolutely, they're leaders. And that's why we work with leadership, right? Leaders have to do that work. And so that's why I do this work.
Well, Dr. Abdulrahman, thank you very much for this, sitting here with me and having this conversation. Do you have any last minute thoughts or ideas you'd like to share with our listeners?
No, I'm just really kind of humbled by the work that you do. And I just want to state that, that you offer, I think you offer people of color, psychologists of color, this platform to talk about their work and their experience, and to have that exclusive platform, so to speak, I think is an act of affirmative action and allyship on its own that I think we need more of. So thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you for saying that. Definitely one of the main reasons why I want to continue doing this.
Yeah.
All right. And I will list your contact information on the show notes. Okay.
Thank you.
Is there anything else?
Nope. That's about it for now.
All right. Well, Dr. Abdulrahman, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you liked this episode. Please subscribe and share. We love to hear from you, so send me a message on LinkedIn or email. The People of Color in Psychology is brought to you by the Multicultural Counseling Institute, and I'm your host, Jack Tseng.